You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5 quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
Sin City Stories contains explicit content that may be disturbing to some listeners, including strong language, graphic details, and depictions of violent crimes. Listener discretion is advised. With the passage of the 18th Amendment and the Federal Volstead Act, liquor was, by and large, made illegal across the United States starting in 1920, including in the tiny, newly formed desert town of Las Vegas. This immediately created a lucrative black market for the illicit sale of alcohol, and along with it came an explosion of violent crime as competing rackets fought for control of this new underground market. Since its founding on May 15, 1905, Las Vegas has gone from being a small railway stop in the middle of the Mojave Desert to a glittering neon oasis of gambling, shopping, fine dining, and entertainment, welcoming tens of millions of visitors from around the world every year. Through its relatively short history, the city has been witness to over a century's worth of murder, robberies, arson, and mayhem. And that's what we're here to share with you. In collaboration with mayheminthedesert.com, this is Sin City Stories, Vegas True Crime, the sordid tales behind the stranger-than-fiction history of fabulous Las Vegas, Nevada. One of the first major arrests in Southern Nevada for violating prohibition laws occurred shortly after the celebrations concluded to usher in the new year of 1920. Lon Grosbeck, a well-known resident of Las Vegas, who had run into legal troubles in the prior few years for illegal gambling, was arrested on January 2nd. His crime was delivering nearly two dozen bottles of Old McBrayer brand whiskey to the Northern, one of the saloons that continued to operate in the open around Vegas even after Prohibition went into effect. Certain public officials and the local newspaper had been clamoring for the arrest of Grosbeck for months, with the local paper dubbing him King of the Bootleggers. But Clark County Sheriff Sam Gay refused to take action. And Grosbeck would have continued to do his part in keeping Las Vegas a wet city had the local district attorney, A.J. Stebbin, not gone over the sheriff's head. The district attorney obtained an arrest warrant directly from the local district court judge and then proceeded to round up two deputy sheriffs. The DA and the deputy set up a few blocks from the Northern to plan the logistics of their raid. Unfortunately for Sheriff Gay, he was strolling by as the trio plotted how they'd enter the drinking establishment, and the district attorney recruited the sheriff as a reluctant backup. The four men walked through the front door of the Northern, past a smattering of patrons, and into the back rooms of the establishment. There, they encountered Grosbeck in bed and woke the traveling bootlegger. It didn't take long for Grosbeck to realize the purpose for this late-night visit. He referenced a half-empty bottle of whiskey on his nightstand and told the midnight interlopers,
"There is all I have. You can use that against me if you want to."
Sheriff Gay likely would have been satisfied with that answer, but the district attorney continued to search the room until he came across a trunk filled with the illicit hooch shipment. D.A. Stebbin ordered Grossbeck to be placed under arrest and hauled to the county jail, but the bootlegger protested that he was recovering from a severe cold and he was permitted to continue resting in his bed in the back room of the Northern. When Judge Henry Lillis set bail at $500 for the well-known bootlegger, Grossbeck simply wrote a check for the hefty amount on the spot. 5 days later, Lon Grossbeck appeared with his attorney before Judge Lillis, one of the local officials keen on turning a blind eye to the illegal liquor business. The bootlegger entered a plea of guilty, and the judge proceeded to sentence Grossbeck to pay a $400 fine and spend 3 months in jail. But the jail sentence would be suspended, provided Grossbeck immediately pay his fine and leave the city limits of Las Vegas. Grossbeck happily tendered the $400 and headed back to his room at the Northern. District Attorney Stebbin adamantly protested Judge Lillis's decision to suspend the jail sentence, arguing, correctly, that there was no legal basis for the judge to grant this clemency to violators of the Prohibition Law. This forced the DA's office to scramble to prepare the paperwork necessary to appeal the suspended sentence to the presiding judge in the county, Judge William Orr. Judge Orr granted an order for Judge Lillis to reverse his decision and have Grossbeck imprisoned in the local jail. Judge Lillis then had the order of commitment delivered to a deputy sheriff. However, the deputy then delayed for over an hour before taking the 10-minute walk to the Northern to make the arrest. To nobody's surprise, Grossbeck had taken advantage of the 3-hour lag between Judge Lillis suspending his sentence and the deputy arriving to make the arrest. He had fled from Las Vegas for a friendlier environment. The local newspaper expressed the fury of a certain upstanding segment of the Las Vegas populace, taking particular offense that the only people penalized up to that time under Prohibition were a few of the drunks and the casual bootlegger, the little fellow, while the chief offenders pursued their calling in security. Prohibition came into effect across the nation on January 17, 1920. But Las Vegas in 1920 was an isolated desert outpost, a forgettable stop on the way to and from California. This helped the town manage to largely avoid strong enforcement of prohibition laws, but the morally crusading local newspaper decried the sight of intoxicated men stumbling about the saloon district and chastised the local authorities for not doing enough to stem the flow of illegal booze. Tensions over the town's permissive attitudes towards alcohol came to the fore when on the afternoon of November 22, 1921, a young man by the name of Nick Dugan burst through the door of Lambert's Cafe in downtown Las Vegas. Walking with an uneasy step, he made his way through the crowded room to the lunch counter, where he took his seat in a manner that made his presence known. Dugan hollered over to a waitress, demanding a cup of coffee and a sandwich. When a waitress brought over the order, Dugan immediately began yelling obscenities at the woman.
One patron in the crowded restaurant had enough of this spectacle.
Marcus Wuerl, a decade-long resident of Las Vegas, rose from his table and told Dugan, "Shut up and get out."
Dugan pulled a revolver and turned on Wuerl.
"You gonna make me?"
There was a moment of hesitation on the part of Wuerl before he made the decision to confront the drunken interloper.
Wuerl managed to grab Dugan's wrist and nearly wrestle the gun from his hand, but not before Dugan used his strength to push the barrel of the gun against Wuerl's side and pull the trigger. A shot rang out in the crowded restaurant. Wuerl stumbled back and turned. Dugan fired another shot into the man's back,
and Wuerl collapsed to the floor.
Dugan stepped over his unconscious victim and hurled more obscenities before exiting the establishment through a back door. When alcohol was involved with a murder, the local newspaper wasted no time highlighting the role drunkenness had played in the violent affair. It came out that Dugan,
who by all accounts had a sterling reputation and was traveling to Las Vegas on business,
had dropped by Block 16 earlier that day. Block 16 was the city's red light district. While touring the dive bars where liquor and beer still flowed despite prohibition, Dugan had 14 shots of moonshine over a few-hour period. Around 5 or 6 that afternoon, he stumbled over to Fremont Street and wandered into Lambert's Cafe, where his fateful encounter with Marcus Wuerl would occur. The role of booze in the local community wasn't the only centerpiece of the Dugan trial. The Nevada legislature had recently voted to mandate that women be included in local jury pools. This led to the first women jurors in Las Vegas' history serving during the trial of Nick Dugan. There was a considerable amount of concern at the time among local Las Vegas attorneys who worried that women would be unable to justly decide a case involving an attractive or magnetic man like Nick Dugan. Dugan testified at his own trial, alleging that he didn't recall anything after about 5 o'clock in the evening on November 22nd.
The last thing he remembered was taking a shot of moonshine in the back of one of the dives along Block 16.
And the next thing he knew, he woke up in the local jail. Guards at the jail and a local doctor supported Dugan's version of events by noting he'd been violently ill after regaining his senses at the city hall,
likely from alcohol poisoning.
Meanwhile, Clark County District Attorney Harley Harmon showed no mercy toward Dugan and argued for the death penalty. He sought to make an example of the young man with an aim to show that illegal drunkenness would no longer be an excuse for violence. Defeating the concerns of the entirely male local bar, the women of the jury urged a conviction of second-degree murder due to the wanton nature of Dugan's crime.
After all, he had discharged a firearm in a crowded restaurant after inviting Wuerl to do something to stop his abusive behavior.
After over 5 hours of deliberation, the men of the jury apparently convinced their fellow jurors to return a verdict for voluntary manslaughter due to Dugan's extreme state of intoxication and lack of memory of the homicide. Dugan only served 3 years in the Nevada State Prison before being released on parole. Las Vegas in 1931 was still a small town of just 5,000 people, but that was rapidly changing due to one of the largest construction projects in U.S. history taking place only 30 miles south of the city, the building of the Boulder Dam. One recent arrival to Las Vegas around this time was John Hall, a 52-year-old traveler from North Carolina. Hall arrived to town with his wife and a plan to ply his new trade as a bootlegger in the waning days of Prohibition. While living in a rented cottage located on the isolated Fox Ranch about 7 miles south of Las Vegas, Hall met another newcomer,
John C. O'Brien.
O'Brien had recently arrived to the Vegas area with his wife and teenage stepdaughter. O'Brien eventually approached Hall with a business proposal. O'Brien knew a man willing to sell him moonshine for $2 a gallon. If Hall would front the money for the wholesale purchase of the moonshine, O'Brien would repay Hall with 50 cents on the dollar. Hall was game, and the two men shook on the deal. One night, in early June of 1931, Hall and O'Brien loaded into a car and drove off to meet O'Brien's contact. As they drove over the unpaved dirt roads, Hall clutched a coffee can in his lap containing $680.
Or the equivalent of about $10,000 today.
The meeting with O'Brien's contact was a bust, but when Hall awoke the next morning, the $680 was missing from the coffee can. He immediately woke O'Brien and accused him of stealing the money. O'Brien swore to his new friend and business associate, "I know this looks bad, but I didn't take the money." 2 days later, Hall accompanied O'Brien on a trip into Las Vegas to visit a local establishment where O'Brien sold his bootleg liquor. The men later went out that evening with their wives and indulged in heavy drinking. After the group returned to the Fox Ranch late that night, Hall and his wife stepped out of the car. Hall walked a few feet, but his emotions, loosened by alcohol, took control. He turned back towards the car and said,
"Jack, your folks have been spending my money around here pretty free, and I've heard some other things. I want to talk with you about them."
O'Brien began to roll away in his car. Hall demanded that he stop. When O'Brien kept inching forward, Hall pulled out a revolver and emptied it into the driver's side of the vehicle. O'Brien was hit in the back with 3 38 rounds. He'd eventually be taken to a local hospital, where he died of his wounds. Meanwhile, Mrs. O'Brien and her daughter abandoned the vehicle and ran into the desert seeking safety. Panic soon set in for Hall over what he'd done.
He and his wife fled immediately after the shooting.
The Halls eventually managed to catch a lift on the back of a passing truck. Hall, still inebriated and consumed by rage at the theft of his money, boasted to the driver of the truck that he'd hate for the boys back in the Carolinas to know that he'd only hit O'Brien with 3 of his 6 shots.
Particularly in light of Hall's prowess as a marksman while serving in the military in the Philippines.
Hall and his wife remained on the lam for a month before being taken into custody by a California highway patrolman in Yermo. At trial, Hall maintained he was acting in self-defense, alleging that O'Brien had reached for his own pistol prior to Hall opening fire. But his statements to multiple people after the shooting that O'Brien had gotten what he deserved sunk him at trial. He was convicted after a day of jury deliberations and sentenced to death. Hall was transported to Carson City and was brought to the gas chamber at the Nevada State Prison on November 28, 1932. He went with a supremely calm demeanor. The prison doctor registered his pulse at a normal 84 beats per minute, and he didn't even flinch when the cyanide pellets landed into a crock of water, creating the lethal gas. John Hall was apparently under the belief that a future feat of medical science would be able to bring him back from the dead. He had requested his attorneys to donate his body to a San Francisco doctor who had recently saved the life of a medical student accidentally injected with cyanide. With the medical student, treatment for the cyanide poisoning had been administered before the patient perished, but Hall was apparently under the mistaken impression that he could be revived from death by cyanide poisoning.
The doctor in San Francisco refused to accept Hall's body.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get 2 select 2 or 2.5 quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
On the night of April 22, 1932, longtime Las Vegas resident Joe Santini exited the pool hall he owned downtown on Stewart Avenue and made the short walk across the alley that sat between his establishment and his house. Santini opened the gate to the fence surrounding his home and entered the yard. He had just finished closing the gate behind him when a flashlight flicked on, shining blinding light into Santini's face. Two shadowy figures approached, and one asked,
"Are you the proprietor of this place?"
"Yes," Santini replied. Having gotten their answer, one of the two men fired a single shot that struck the pool hall owner in the abdomen. The shooter let the pistol drop to the ground. Then the attackers fled in opposite directions and into the darkness. Meanwhile, Santini stumbled back to his business and collapsed soon after re-entering the building. He was rushed to the hospital where the district attorney and sheriff attempted to get information about the assailants.
Santini died from his wounds within a few days of the attack,
issuing a final statement in his native Italian, but before a translator could be summoned. Following the Santini murder, several other Italian immigrants associated with illegal bootlegging operations in the red light district of Las Vegas fled the city. Joe Santini had been involved in illegal liquor sales at his pool hall for years, and he'd also had a hand in the management of several local illicit bootlegging operations. Santini was heavily associated with what the Vegas press called the troublesome gangster element. The subsequent police investigation discovered that it was a well-known secret among local underworld characters that Santini had been marked for death as a result of a dispute over the local liquor trade. Things took a further tragic turn a few weeks later when one of Santini's close friends from the Nevada town of Cayente traveled to Las Vegas in order to investigate his friend's slaying. Vittorio Decimo stayed at the same small house in downtown Las Vegas where his friend had been gunned down. But on the night of May 29, 1932, Decimo was killed by a single shot to the head while lying in bed inside the Santini home. Decimo had been stopped before his independent inquiry into his friend's untimely death could even begin. Rumors circulated that local police were paid off, as the killings of Santini and Decimo were two of only three unsolved homicides up to that point in the short 27-year history of Las Vegas. And despite the sheriff conducting what publicly appeared to be a diligent search for suspects, the killings remained unsolved. Shortly before 10 o'clock, on the night of June 22, 1932, a bundle of dynamite was left at the rear of what was supposed to be the town's newest speakeasy in the red light district of Las Vegas. The improvised explosive device blew apart the rear of the building, sending debris flying through the empty bar and shattering the structure's plumbing fixtures.
The basement of the would-be speakeasy flooded, with water seeping into the storage room of a popular men's clothing store next door.
Several boarders were sleeping in rooms above the speakeasy, and though startled, none were injured in the bombing. The bombed speakeasy was owned by the proprietors of another illegal liquor establishment that operated largely in the open, called Number 10 Stewart Street. Well before mobsters from back east made their mark in Las Vegas, the year 1932 saw a gang war erupt between local bootleggers and speakeasy owners across the small town of just a few thousand people. The owners of No. 10 Stewart Street had been subjected to several armed holdups by rival gangs in the months leading up to the bombing. One theory from law enforcement officers at the time was that word had gotten out that the owners of No. 10 Stewart Street had assisted the police in arresting members of the gang responsible for the armed robberies.
It was believed the bombing of the speakeasy on First Street was an act of retaliation.
The late-night bombing in downtown Las Vegas created public pressure for an official response, and that response came swiftly. The day after the attack on the planned speakeasy, Clark County Sheriff Joe Keat declared, "The time has come to find out who's running this town, the bootleggers or the officers." A meeting was convened that same day between Sheriff Keat, Las Vegas Police Chief Clay Williams, and District Attorney Harley Harmon. The trio made plans to fight back against the bootleggers. Local law enforcement promptly shuttered the city's well-known speakeasies over the next few days, with Sheriff Keat warning of harsh consequences for those that made any effort to reopen the liquor emporiums,
as the local press referred to the establishments.
While the speakeasies lining the red light district of Las Vegas were shut down, many of the saloons dotting Boulder Highway, the artery connecting Las Vegas to the newly established town of Boulder City, continued their operations without interference in the aftermath of the bombing. No culprits were ever arrested in retaliation to the bombing, and with the end of Prohibition in 1933, the violence tied to the bootlegging rackets largely came to an end. Prohibition in the United States came to an end on December 5, 1933, with the ratification of the 21st Amendment of the Constitution. And although the repealing of Prohibition marked the end of a period of widespread bootlegging and social turmoil, it made way for the other more familiar facets of organized crime to work their way into Las Vegas. To learn more about this Las Vegas true crime story and many others, visit mayheminthedesert.com and get yourself acquainted with the darker side of Sin City's history. Sin City Stories, Vegas True Crime, is based on material researched and written by Megan and Anthony Smith and is adapted for podcast, edited, and narrated by Jeff Walker. Sin City Stories, Vegas True Crime, is a co-production of Mayhem in the Desert and Walker New Media. Copyright 2024.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.